This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the good people and wondrous places of Southern California. I am Sir Matt Gillum, in for his lordship Steve Chitakis, and I bid thee a good day.
Ladies, lords, and good gentles all,
I invite you to be transported into the days of yore.
Her Majesty herself, Queen Elizabeth, with three hearty huzzas. Hip, hip!
Fair listener, welcome to the Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale, where guests and performers alike trade in their t-shirts and jeans for ruffs, doublets, and corsets.
When they enter in these gates, they may be whatever they want, for they step into a realm where fantasy rules!
This year marks the fair's 60th anniversary, and 6 weeks into their annual run, it's busy out here. But like the rest of us, the Renaissance Fair has been afflicted by the very real plague that kept us safer at home. Lots of actors left. Now, the fair is in a period of rebuilding. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo tells us how.
The Renaissance Fair. I mean, where else can you find copious amounts of mead, beautiful ornate costumes, and jousting? I mean, come on. Armored knights riding real horses?
Oh, yes! Yes! Utter destruction in the field!
What's not to like? Every spring for about 7 weekends, the grassy lakeside picnic area at the Santa Fe Dam Recreation Area is transformed into a 16th century English village. Think wood beams, canvas, and dusty unpaved roads. And a commoner looking to make a few dollars. Farthings.
I be selling the finest cabbages in all the land. Would you like to purchase one for but one farthing apiece? Very cruciferous crunchy. A beautiful bouquet of flavors.
Turn a corner, and you may very well find a group of wenches washing the day's garb while singing a tune. But it is also here where the 21st century version of the bubonic plague hit, and some of those folks playing fantasy up and fled the village to head to safety.
My guild has gotten very small. A lot of the acting groups at the fair have lost members. So it's gotten much smaller. At its heyday, my group had like up to 150 people in it. This year we're down to less than half of that.
Meet Sue Honor, the head of the Guild of St. Cuthbert's, a group of actors who parade the fairgrounds and march with the Queen when called upon.
We're all aging. Sometimes it's harder to bring in the younger kids because as a leader who's aging, you know, when I became the Guildmaster, I was in my early 20s. Now I'm in my 60s, you know. I'm not as appealing a leader to young folk as a younger director would be.
She says it's been tough trying to attract the new generation to don the costumes and old English accents.
I've recruited some younger minds to help me get into the heads of younger folk to try to, you know, send out the right message so that they know that there's something for them in this and not just us old creaky people.
In the meantime, they're keeping an eye out for people who might want to work the fair but just don't know it yet. Overexcited guests or local arts programs at high schools and community colleges, even neighborhood theaters. Then there are the future Renfesters who don't have to have it all explained to them. Enter the Fair Brats.
This is not actually a negative. They call kids who were raised at fair, Fair Brats. Not because they're actually bratty. It's a term of endearment.
This is Jessica Canaday. When she isn't tearing up the stage with the all-women musical group, the Merry Wives of Windsor.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
She's a high school teacher, wife, and mom of three, including Rowan Canaday. A.K.A.
I am Lady Dorothy Devereux. I am related to the Queen very distantly.
Yes, that's right. Jessica's 15-year-old daughter, Rowan, plays an aristocrat at the fair, alongside her husband, Charles, and their son, Liam. The kids grew up there.
They look forward to fair all year, and they get super excited when fair season is about to hit. When build comes, they're like, we're going to see our friends, we're going to see our family. That's how they view it. We didn't have to make it a family affair. It just was one.
Yeah, sometimes I tell people that I've been working at Fair like my whole life, and they don't imagine it to be my whole life, but I mean it as my whole life.
Today, Rowan works in the Queen's Court. She's also dabbled in other roles.
We're learning like practical skills, like being able to talk in front of a crowd well. I know falconry as well. So I know how to like launch a bird from a glove and like make it come to the other glove.
Rowan says she wants to continue working at Fair, even when she's in college, carrying on the Renaissance Fair traditions into the next generation. And there's lots of Rowans, so many that every year the Fair hosts Fair Brat Day. Julie McMillan is the Fair's social media director and a former Renfair performer herself.
Seeing the kids come as a horde and seeing how many of them there are and realizing that it really is a true generational thing, that there are Fair Brats having Fair Brats at this point.
Julie's optimistic for the Fair's future, seeing the community kids come up together at Fair and grow as people.
We've all encountered this place that allows us to play, and we want to make sure that it continues to exist for this year's audience, next year's audience.
In fact, Fair's always been a family affair. Remember Sue Honor, St. Cuthbert's Guildmaster? She got her start when she was just 10 years old during the Fair's earliest days.
My mother, Anita, was a craftswoman, and she made hooked rugs. She had a booth, and being her kid, me and my brother, we were brought out to the Fair. Back in those days, it was 3 weekends, and we enjoyed it. The whole family came out, including the dog.
Decades later, Sue's own kids and even grandkids have followed suit.
My granddaughter, she's a teenager. I remember that right before COVID, she was sad because she was 12 at the end of Fair, and the next time we did Southern Fair, she was going to be a teenager. And so she couldn't be a kid anymore because she was going to be a teenager. And we all explained to her, oh, no, honey, you know, we're all a variety of ages and we're still kids. You know, when we come to Fair next time, we're still going to be those same kids.
So between the Fair Brats and recruiting going on, there's lots of hope for the future. And meanwhile, the Fair is still going strong with no shortage of guests strolling through what's essentially Comic-Con for history nerds. And there's still time to check it out this year. This weekend marks the Fair's last weekend, at least until next spring. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Just ahead for us, we'll hear about a new exhibit atop Mount Wilson at the observatory. It contrasts scientific instruments with handmade textiles based on images collected by the facility's famous telescope. That's coming up on Greater LA. More now with Greater LA. I'm Matt Gillum. Giants in the field of astrophysics and astronomy like George Hale and Edwin Hubble ascended Mount Wilson and peered at the sky there, making discoveries that forever altered our understanding of the solar system and the universe. A new art exhibit is taking up residence at the Mountaintop Observatory, specifically in the dome housing the famous 100-inch Hooker telescope, which was the largest instrument of its kind for more than 30 years. UC Santa Barbara art professor Sarah Rosalina is using some of astronomy's most hallowed ground to showcase textiles based on images captured by the colossal telescope in a new exhibit called Standard Candle. She's joining us along with Joel Faree, the program director of LACMA's Art and Tech Lab. Sarah, Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so Sarah, I want to begin with the name of your exhibit, Standard Candle. I, like probably a lot of people, didn't know this is actually a unit of astronomical measurement. What exactly is a standard candle, and why did you feel it was the right moniker for the show?
So the term standard candle is a type of celestial body that's used to create measurement, particularly from Earth, and major discoveries of our universe expanding at their other galaxies outside our own are based on this measurement. But it's actually due to female computers who studied tediously the brightness and dimness of a Cepheid variable star. And by setting the brightness and dimness, they were able to use a term kind of like that's similar to parallax by analyzing that. So it required a tremendous amount of data and analysis to produce that. So, you know, this show is really kind of using this idea of standard candle as a way to examine women's labor, colonialism, and how it created these major advancements in Western scientific thought and imaging of space.
All right, now, Joel, I've been to a lot of exhibits in my time, but I have never been to one on the top of a mountain in a world-renowned observatory. How did LACMA manage to stage this show in such a remarkable place?
It's really due to, our art and technology program that we have at the museum. It's a program that looks at the relationship between art and technology here in Los Angeles, and then also at a more global level. But we do see ourselves based here in our sort of regional community. We've been looking at Mount Wilson for a while as a potential venue. I had been in conversation with Dan Coney, who is a trustee from the observatory, for a couple of years now, about forming or doing some kind of collaboration. It's such an iconic site, and the museum, through our art and technology program, has this ability to sort of foster different experimental approaches to engaging artists, to staging installations, to developing new technologies.
Well, Sarah, you've talked about the female computers. These are the women that did sort of monumental calculations for NASA and were involved in sort of the development of space technology. They're a major influence on this exhibit. How did you learn about these sort of unsung heroes of the space race?
So I've been very interested in female computers for quite a long time. My title as a professor is computational craft. And so, you know, being a woman, being interested in, you know, computers, computer programming, as a woman, you find out that, you know, there's a long lineage of, you know, people being titled that. You know, when I first started studying about, you know, the history of the computer, like the first one that we even know of was the ENIAC, which was a computer used by the U.S. military in World War II, which was programmed by six women, the ENIAC 6. These are things you normally don't hear about, you know, growing up or, you know, being interested in any type of computer. And so that kind of led me down a long path of actually studying their role. And when it comes to the space race, I also was aware of this because my grandfather worked at JPL and also had to utilize a lot of computer work or computer information that were done by women, which, again, it's this whole genre of history, this whole, of people just being completely erased. And we forget all the labor that goes into our computers even today with AI, which, again, becomes problematic.
Well, you mentioned the influence of your mother and your grandmother. I think you said a family loom is what you used for creating some of this beadwork. How are they part of this show?
For me, it's very much like a way to incorporate multi-cosmology. So different ways of imaging and thinking about space. Just like, you know, how Hubble was able to prove that the universe is expanding. That's one way of breaking away from one cosmology and introducing multi-cosmologies. So there's also multiple ways that you can see and view the universe. And so with this show, I'm really bringing in my culture, my traditions, and showing there's different ways that you can also map and visualize, because so much of mapping, cartography, has been used against Black and brown people, particularly in the U.S. So this show is really a way to kind of like deconstruct how imaging is created from, you know, a place that, you know, we no longer can even see stars because of light pollution, and, you know, creating a much bigger dialogue that kind of incorporates the past and the future to kind of rethink what cosmology is, not in terms of just looking at stars, but how we generate knowledge.
But art and technology have always been intertwined. I mean, scopes and other, quote, new devices can be seen in paintings from hundreds of years ago. Today, AI is generating fantastic pictures few could imagine. Joel, I mean, how do you see this exhibit fitting into that sort of art and science technology continuum?
It really takes artists to give us another viewpoint into this larger narrative of scientific progress. And it's part of the work that we do, having artists contribute to this greater dialogue around art and science and art and technology. It's as we move forward and as technological progress continues to pick up and get faster and faster, I think we're going to become increasingly dependent on artists to help us shape our point of view, both looking back at our past, but also telling us where we should go.
Well, Sarah, what seed do you hope your art and the Standard Candle exhibit plant in the viewer's mind?
So I'm really interested in, you know, bringing multiple knowledges to the table because, you know, it also creates a more varied account of our universe. But the main important thing is, you know, different information, different knowledges always comes in different forms. And this form is really highlighting indigenous cosmology, indigenous knowledge, which hasn't been a larger part of the dialogue, and particularly in science, for many reasons, because of its root in, you know, how imperial power was even formed. Like, even the power of Mount Wilson itself brought the aerospace industry to Southern California. If it wasn't for major discoveries taken there, we would not have Caltech, we would not have JPL. Southern California would be a very different place. So seeing it as a site of power into gazing and knowing our universe, I really want people to go to the place and also to think critically about the history of what happened in that space, but also to also view stars in a new way. And so this kind of dual way of seeing is something that I really hope people take from the show and also just enjoy the beauty of the textiles and beadwork.
Sarah Rosalina, Joel Farid, thanks so much for coming on and sharing some details about the exhibit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back now with more of Greater LA, I'm Matt Gillum. The struggle of what to wear, it's a complicated series of decisions we make every day. While many of us rummage through the closet to find the perfect shirt or those pants that fit just right, one artist has opted not to be stressed about getting dressed. Andrea Zittel, who lives in Joshua Tree and has crafted personal uniforms for herself since the early 90s. A new exhibit at the Regan Projects in Hollywood showcases 48 of the handmade garments Zittel designed and wore between 2013 and this year. Lindsay Preston Zappas is editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles and our art insider, and she's here to tell us more about the show. Hey there, Lindsay.
Hey, Matt.
All right, so give us some background on Zittel. She's originally from SoCal, was on the East Coast for a bit, and then came back to the high desert. What's her work like?
Yeah, exactly. So she was born in SoCal in Escondido. As a young artist, she went to New York and started making work there really in the 90s. But she's lived in Joshua Tree for the last 20 years or so. And, you know, her practice has always involved this question of how do we live? It's a very broad question, right? But, you know, her practice is kind of what we would call social practice. So for her, her art and her life are kind of the same thing. They're super enmeshed. And, you know, how she lives her life day to day really turns into her artistic output. And, you know, her work really spills out from this place. So for example, in the 90s, you know, she named her 200 square foot tiny Brooklyn apartment AZ East, kind of gave it this grand name. And she really started to play with this idea of how she could optimize the space and live in really intentional ways. And so, you know, in the last 20 years, she moved to Joshua Tree. She named that property AZ West. And, you know, she's really continued these types of experiments for living out in the desert.
Well, I mean, a lot of Zittel's pieces center on the rituals of day-to-day life. This new show fits in with that sort of ideal. Walk us through the project and some of the garments that we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. So this project also has been going on since the 90s. She sort of separated the series into three decades of these uniforms. So the current show, On View at Regan, represents the most recent decade, up until 2023. And, you know, the idea is that Zatel creates a uniform, she calls them. Again, another grand name. She loves to name these projects. And she'll wear that one outfit for the entire season. So she'll just put on the same thing every day. And, you know, the uniforms have evolved over the years. They've included different fiber techniques, different clothing techniques. And the new series is mostly hand-sewn garments, a lot of long skirts in a lot of the uniforms. And her AZ West studio actually has a weaving studio. So in this collection, we also see a lot of woven garments on the uniforms.
We said she wears the same thing every day. What about if there's bad weather? What if you need to dress up and go somewhere?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's part of the constraint, right? Her early uniform projects in New York were only separated by two seasons. So she would have fall and winter, spring and summer. So two outfits a year. But after moving to the desert and the extreme temperature changes there, she had to shift into four seasons. So now there's four uniforms a year. And I think she intentionally designs them in a way that they sort of adapt to all these different contexts. So they're very practical for desert life. She uses a lot of really sturdy materials like cottons and denims. And yet they're kind of fashionable in a very kind of minimal, simplistic way.
This isn't her first collection, as you pointed out. She's been at this for more than 30 years. And you mentioned how she has these rules and sort of these self-imposed restrictions she puts on herself to guide the style of the collections. Can you talk more about some of the limitations and how that could actually maybe be a good thing?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I think she has said that what actually makes us feel liberated is not freedom, right? Which is kind of a
okay.
Just bold statement. But she says, actually, it's limitations. Limitations actually lead us to freedom. And so I think this impulse has to do with this idea of constraints, right? That by eliminating the choice of what to wear, it sort of sets us free from that social pressure, that sort of consumerist mindset that a lot of us have. And these types of constraints are really key to her day-to-day life and her art practice. So another example, for instance, is she uses a set of handmade bowls that she calls AZ containers, another grand name. And she uses that for drinking, eating. Basically she's combining the plate, the cup, the mug, the wine glass into one bowl vessel. And one thing can kind of do it all. So there's this kind of monastic simplicity to how she lives. And that ethos of restriction is really a cornerstone for her.
Well, really quickly, let's talk a little bit about how these uniforms are displayed. When you walk into the gallery, all 48 of them that she wore over the years are set up in a grid. You can walk between them, see them from all sides. What do you make of how she wants us to look at these outfits?
Definitely. I mean, for me, it's really interesting that she's always chosen to show the uniforms like this, sort of in these dense grids. To me, it sort of conveys the passing of time. They're almost set up like a calendar, right? So sort of in these grids. And I think the grid also removes this idea that one garment is better than the other or any one needs to kind of be focused on or marveled at. And instead, they're kind of all just lumped together in this very utilitarian way. It goes back to this idea of uniform and kind of getting the job done.
All right. Well, you can check out Andrea Zatel's personal uniforms at Regan Projects through May 27th. Lindsay Preston Zappas is the founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Matt.
And that is going to do it for today. Tomorrow, voices from the picket lines as the strike by the Writers Guild continues with no end in sight. And what about directors and actors? They're in the early stages of negotiating their contracts, too. What are their issues, and what could all of this mean for Hollywood and the region if work stoppages keep going for a long time? Our website is kcw.com/GLA. Head there to give us feedback on the show and let us know about stories you think we should be covering. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together today. I'm Matt Gillum. Thanks so much for your time. Have a fantastic rest of your evening.